of a dead soldier. What made this campaign uniquely grim was the proximity of the fighting and the extraordinary terrain over which the two armies clashed. It was indeed at times a knife fight out of the Stone Age, as historian Eric Berger had wrote. The Kokoda campaign is distinguished for three other reasons. It was the first land defeat of the Japanese Imperial Army. It marked the start of the great rollback of the Japanese troops from the southernmost point of the Pacific Empire, and it was the battle that saved Australia from certain isolation and possible invasion, as it was perceived at the time, in the Pacific War. Against this backdrop, the heated argument over the correct name of the jungle path along which the Australians and the Japanese fought seems trivial. To my mind, a track is little different from a trail or path, and I have used these terms interchangeably. Where I formally identify it, I use Kokoda Track, because that is the preferred name of the Isarava Memorial and most soldiers. Incidentally, a research paper by Peter Provis on the subject, commissioned by the Australian War Memorial, concludes that trail is technically correct, but concedes that either may be used. For which clarity one is, I suppose, thankful. Part 1. Landing. Chapter 1. Missionaries. Dry your tears. Perhaps they are a Teonaso, our friends. Father James Benson to a Papuan boy on seeing the Japanese ships. On the afternoon of the 21st of July, 1942, a humble Christian missionary was fixing his deck chair in his shed by the Solomon Sea. Father James Benson enjoyed pottering about with his tools at Gona Mission on the north coast of Papua. The little deck chair served a special function for this Yorkshire-born clergyman. He would perch himself upon it aboard the native outriggers that plied his coastal parish. Benson, the Anglican missionary at Gona since 1937, was a respected local figure. He'd devoted himself to the spiritual well-being of his small flock, many of whose ancestors were headhunters. And while not every Papuan had converted to Christianity as enthusiastically as he might have hoped, Benson could not complain. His parish numbered several hundred, and those parishioners who had not gone bush were models of zealous attentiveness. Two decades earlier, their tribes had been warriors and cannibals, who solved tribal disputes with bloodshed, and whose trophies of war were the shriveled heads of their real or imagined enemies. They were the Orokaiva and Bindanere people, with a reputation for being bellicose in the extreme and the most rampant and obstinate savages, in the view of the Australian governor of Papua in 1923. No doubt their thorough headhunting raids on neighbouring villages were uneconomic, as he also observed. The flaxen-haired Orokaivans, whose oiled ringlets grew into a mass of tails, pencil-thick, and fell about their shoulders in the manner of a Chief Justice's wig, were notoriously superstitious, and the Australian government deemed it seemly to stamp out an interesting snake ritual in which the village witch doctor induced in his patients paroxysms of a peculiarly horrible nature. Yet in time, these powerfully built people adapted to white rule and agreeably sheathed their scalping knives to participate in the less dangerous diversions introduced by the colonial power, chiefly cricket and football. Western controls were introduced. The Orokaivans who joined the local constabulary gained a reputation for cheerful bravery, transmuting the ferocious warrior ethos of 1920 into a force for order and relative stability. Notwithstanding Governor Murray's appeal for less Christ and more cricket, some eschewed sorcery for Christianity, and in 1942, some 300 parishioners welcomed the familiar sight of their white-haired preacher, who, sitting up in his outrigger, came by sea to spread the word of the white man's God.